Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, is protesting against Obama's wars. Coming up, it appears that President Obama has less foreign and domestic support for his Syria war than Bush did in Iraq. The long and deadly history of United States chemical warfare and the March on Washington commemoration should serve as the last gasp of the black misleadership class. But first, the script has been flipped on Capitol Hill, where erstwhile progressives and black lawmakers struggle to find a way to support President Obama's war plans, while Republicans play the role of peacemakers. David Swanson is publisher of the influential website War is a Crime. He says the U.S. Congress has gone topsy-turvy.
Capitol Hill is in disarray. Capitol Hill is in the unexpected position of not knowing what it's going to do with the leaders of both houses, particularly of the House of Representatives, in bipartisan fashion among the leadership, wanting to do something, but the majority of their members bizarrely indicating that they are being influenced by the vast majority of the public, which is on the other side, which is very interesting. So the arm twisting is underway, and the doom and gloomers will be forecasting inevitable defeat. But at this moment, it certainly looks like they won't be able to pass an attack on Syria through the House, which could end up meaning that the House holds no vote because, as you know, the Speaker only brings things to the floor that he thinks are going to pass, which could conceivably mean that a majority of House members force a vote over the head of the Speaker and vote no. We'll see. It's very interesting. They've handed this to us on a silver platter, an announced war that doesn't begin for a week or two. Usually they just go ahead and start a war and tell us later. So this is an opportunity to start to build an anti-war movement that's already been taken great advantage of in Britain, where the parliament has refused a prime minister's request for war for the first time since they decided to surrender at Yorktown.
The bloc that forced the issue on Capitol Hill was largely Tea Party. How has the Congressional Progressive Caucus comported itself in this crisis?
Some of the usual anti-war members, such as Congresswoman Barbara Lee, have been remarkably weak and unhelpful. The Progressive Caucus has two co-chairs, Raul Grijalva, who says he's against the war, but you don't see him doing anything about it, and Keith Ellison, who is actively pro-war. So you have a split leadership in a so-called Progressive Caucus, and little if no action from most of its members, a handful of exceptions. Congressman Alan Grayson and his staff working hard to stop this thing. Congressman Nolan, Congressman McDermott, you know, a few others pushing back. But for the most part, the Progressive Caucus has reached a new low. You know, that 6 years ago, they made commitments they would vote against war funding, and most of them turned around and voted for it, and we sort of stopped believing in them. And then they started just putting out vague press releases, and we stopped paying attention. Now they don't do anything, or they're split and are actually half pro-war and half anti-war. So it would be very, very beneficial to have a peace caucus rather than this vague progressive caucus with no standards and no requirements for membership. It would be great to have even a caucus of three members who actually stood against war. There have been such things in U.S. history in the Congress, in both houses. Today we seem to be lacking it.
That is amazing. Barbara Lee, the only member of Congress that voted against the invasion of Afghanistan, and yet you say is not being resolute on this peace issue.
Yeah, you're not seeing leadership from the usual Congress members that some of the usual activist groups tend to turn to. And so you're having to build these new relationships between activists and staffers and Congress members to have some coordination there. And Congressman Grayson's staff is helpful in this regard. But you see incredible deference to the president. You have three or four times as many Republicans beginning to make public commitments against this as Democrats. I just ran in the door from visiting and speaking with my Republican congressman, Robert Hurt, in rural Virginia, and I liked everything he said, and he walked right up to the edge of saying he'll vote against this, but he'll be polite and go to Washington and hear them out first. You look at Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, a progressive, if there ever was one, in Washington, D.C., doesn't really have a vote, but she said if she would vote for this plan, which she considers a disaster, she would only do so out of loyalty to President Obama. Most members are not saying that explicitly, but it is clearly the decisive factor. Statistically, Congressman Hurt would be very, very likely to back this war if the president were a Republican. Democrats have turned in favor of attacking Syria in large numbers, clearly because the president is a Democrat.
We've heard often about the possibilities of a left-right alliance over issues of war, with those segments of the right that oppose U.S. entanglements overseas aligning with traditional peace forces. And yet what you're saying is that the traditional or peace-leaning forces are the ones who are inactive, neutered.
Well, it depends. You have some progressive Democrats who used to be in favor of peace who have caved in on this one out of loyalty to the president, and you have others who haven't, and a huge number who have not officially or formally or strongly committed either way, who are waiting to see. Because, of course, many of them will want to vote with the president if they have to and their arm is twisted hard, but vote with their constituents if they can get away with it and the measure still pass. I mean, this is why these votes for unpopular measures tend to be narrow votes, because those who are permitted to vote no, and please their constituents. So you're going to have a lot of undecideds right up until the end, but you have more Republicans leaning against than Democrats. And it makes for a strange anti-war movement, because you have these arguments against war in Syria because the Iraqis weren't grateful for our destruction of their country, and you have this focus on the financial costs and so forth. But I will take anti-war votes anywhere we can get them. And you're seeing the same problem with the Democratic Party-aligned activist groups, so that Democracy for America, this Howard Dean group, polled its members, do you think we should oppose an attack on Syria or not, got the results, didn't tell anybody what they were, and then sent out an email demanding such things as a victory plan. MoveOn.org and PCCC were a little bit better. They stopped and polled their members and then announced that, of course, their members are overwhelmingly against this attack, and then belatedly began pushing back against it. Other groups like Credo got this right, and got it right away, and Roots Action, which I work for, got it right away. But you see this delay or this caving in on the part of groups that would be right out there demanding peace and the rule of law if the president were a Republican.
You're working the Hill. Does anybody up there entertain the possibility that Syria didn't do it?
Oh, a great many, yes. More than that, actually maintain the position, which I think is correct, that there should be no attack on Syria even if the Syrian government did do it. And I think that's correct and remarkable, because in 2003, overwhelmingly the argument was, if Iraq has those weapons, Iraq must be attacked. And if Iraq doesn't, then it shouldn't be attacked, which was the wrong question. I mean, it was immoral, illegal, catastrophic to attack Iraq, even if all the lies had been true. And that is the case here as well. And so when we hear Congress members agreeing with us that we shouldn't be trying to put al-Qaeda in charge of Syria and risking a huge quagmire, if not a global war, over this issue, that it's not our business, that we shouldn't be sending in missiles to enforce laws and so forth, they are exactly right. But to the extent that they do focus on this question of whether Syria did it, you are hearing from many Congress members who've gone in for the classified briefings and come out shocked that they are just not plausible. I mean, the claims that are apparently being made don't even arise to Colin Powell level. They don't have fabricated dialogue, but they don't have any dialogue. They don't have any sources. They don't have any hard evidence. It's just sort of a presentation, and trust me, from people like John Kerry, who voted for the invasion of Iraq and who said as he was running for president, even if he'd known it was all a pile of lies, he still would have voted yes. So now he comes back with his own pile of what is clearly in part a bunch of lies. I mean, they clearly lied about the timing of Syria letting the inspectors in. They've clearly written their dossier to make it sound stronger than it is. I mean, it looks sleazy if you read it in some detail. And we're supposed to trust him because he's John Kerry. I mean, I don't understand that at all.
David Swanson of War is a Crime, speaking from Washington. Even the British, who have been called America's poodles, have refused to go along with Obama's Syria attack. Indeed, most of the world opposes U.S. war plans. According to Omali Yeshitela, chairman of the Black is Back Coalition, the Obama administration's desperation for allies shows that the superpower isn't as super as it used to be.
It's almost like overnight, except it's not, that you look up and see that the U.S. is almost isolated and its influence is waned right before our very eyes, that the toadies that used to run immediately to anything the U.S. wanted done are unable to do it anymore, and Obama stands the chance at this very moment of going down in history as a war criminal, not because he's done anything worse than Bush or Clinton or any of the others, but because Obama has been left with left cover for himself, as you see England and then Germany and various other forces that have usually been reliable partners in crime having to at least immediately and initially distance themselves from this criminal war that the Obama regime is threatening against Syria. It is an extraordinary situation, and increasingly it is going to be very difficult, if it's possible at all, for even many of the Negroes who have sided with Obama, been in bed with Obama, to continue this illicit affair that they've been involved in.
Here in the United States, the corporate media takes it as a given that the Syrian government did actually carry out the chemical attack. But much of the rest of the world doesn't think so.
Nobody in the rest of the world seems to think so. And even the forces like what we're reading coming from France, they're demanding, where is this evidence? And even in the U.S. Congress, there are forces who are saying, well, where is the evidence that this happened? And of course, there is no evidence because it didn't happen that way. And what is so striking about the situation is the level of desperation that's obvious here in the lack of preparation that went into creating the lie about the so-called chemical weapons that were used in Syria by the Syrian government. And the other thing that's extraordinarily striking is that this demonstration of a lack of resources at their command, to the extent that they would have to go to this lie about chemical weapons, that is nothing but a retread of the Colin Powell statement and the U.S. justification for attacking Iraq. I think that it is clear to most people that it is a fabrication. And, of course, I think Putin put it best when he characterized it as the equivalence of rubbish. Nobody believes this, and even I assume and suspect that even most of the people who are in the Congress who are now talking about the possibility of supporting this regime in this war against Syria, I think even they know that it is not true.
You talked about the lack of resources on the part of the U.S. I know you don't mean military resources, of course. What kind of resources were you referring to?
I'm talking about resources such as support in the world, political resources. I'm talking about even creativity that would have them come up with such an incredible lame and weak approach to this. I'm talking about resources that would even include time to plan things. It is as though they have run into a brick wall and that the world is moving and changing at such a rate that they are not able to do things in the same old way.
We talk about Great Britain as being the United States poodle. Some folks think that the Congressional Black Caucus is Barack Obama's poodle. You think they'll act that way with regard to this planned war?
Well, I think they are going to be faced with and are probably being faced now with their greatest challenge in terms of desiring to continue a marriage to this guy. The Congressional Black Caucus has an advantage over most of the politicians in the Congress in that most of the politicians have to really be concerned about only 9% of the people in this country being for this war. The Congressional Black Caucus has a slight advantage, or has had a slight advantage up to now, in that the majority of African people have been blinded by Obama's complexion to the extent that they have been able to support Obama even as they disagree with most of the policies that have come from this regime. Now it's going to be interesting what kind of pressure the Congressional Black Caucus is experiencing. I am not sure, and I am not sure in part because I don't know what kind of demonstration of opposition, other than those that we've been involved in through the Black is Back coalition. I'm not sure how it's resonated in terms of their ability to see their own future as politicians. I know that there is no honor there. I know that there is no integrity that would prevent them from going with Obama. I think it's going to be a matter of how they perceive their own interests at this point. I think even the Congressional Black Caucus has to understand at this point that Obama presidency is broken. It's a broken presidency, and it's going to be interesting to see how they factor their own sense of interest and survival in this current situation.
Omali Yeshetela of the Black is Back Coalition, speaking from St. Petersburg, Florida. U.S. credibility in the world is at an all-time low, and with good reason. John Quigley is Professor Emeritus of International Law at Ohio State University. He's author of the book, Ruses for War, American Interventionism Since World War II. Professor Quigley says the Obama administration is up to the same old tricks as its predecessors.
When I hear Secretary of State Kerry saying that he is confident, quote unquote, of the physical evidence that the sarin gas was used and that the Syrian government was responsible, I immediately think back to prior situations where the administrations have said similar things, and very often it turns out not to be accurate.
Yes, many of us are familiar with the different ruses that are associated with the 2003 invasion of Iraq, but Iraq doesn't stand alone.
That's right. There was something actually rather similar relating to nerve agents in 1998. The Clinton administration, following the attacks on the U.S. embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam, wanted to take some kind of retaliation for that, and they said that in Khartoum, the capital of Sudan, there was a factory that was producing something called EMPTA, which is a precursor for the VX nerve gas, and that this was to be supplied by the government of Sudan to Al-Qaeda. And on the basis of that information, we bombed the plant. It later turned out that probably there was no such production going on at that plant, even though at the time the administration made statements very similar to what Secretary of State Kerry is now saying about the evidence regarding Syria. Different scientists tried to find traces of this precursor agent in the vicinity of the destroyed plant, and they couldn't find any. And finally, this was covered rather extensively by the New York Times, and the New York Times got unnamed administration officials to acknowledge that they really didn't have any evidence.
U.S. officials had many Americans believing that Iraqi intelligence was out to kill President George Bush the Elder.
That's right. This was in Kuwait. He was scheduled to give a speech there in 1993, following the first Gulf War. And a car, a Toyota Land Cruiser, was found in Kuwait with bombs in it. It was never clear, you know, the origin of it, who put them there. But in any event, the Clinton administration, again, said that this was a plot to assassinate George Bush, that the Renault was to have been driven to the place where he was to give a speech to assassinate him, and moreover, that the Iraqi intelligence service was responsible. And their basis for saying the Iraqi intelligence service was responsible was the circuitry found in the Toyota in Kuwait. And Secretary of State Madeleine Albright showed pictures of the circuitry on a screen at a meeting of the UN Security Council to substantiate the U.S. case. Then the bombing did occur, and we wound up killing some people, actually, as also happened in the bombing in Khartoum. Some people were killed in the neighborhood. But subsequent to the bombing of the Iraqi intelligence service in Baghdad, Seymour Hersh got on the case, and he managed to get hold of the circuitry and give it to some explosive experts, and they uniformly said that there was nothing identifiable in the circuitry that would connect it to the Iraqi intelligence service. Albright's point had been that the Iraqi intelligence service had previously used bombs of a particular type of circuitry, and that showed that they were involved here. But his experts said that that wasn't true. And then it turned out there was only one fellow in the FBI that had actually done the analysis of the circuitry, a man named Frederick Whitehurst. And he then, after Albright made this speech at the Security Council, came out publicly and said that he had concluded precisely the opposite, that this circuitry could not be identified as having any connection to the Iraqi government, and that apparently someone higher up in the FBI or the Justice Department had massaged his report before it got to President Clinton.
The U.S. habitually claims that American citizens are in danger and uses that as a pretext for invading countries.
Yes, that's been true a number of times, and it's never been factually accurate. That was true for the Grenada invasion. In 1983, we said that there were medical students at a U.S.-operated medical school in Grenada, and that they were in danger. In fact, there was no danger to them. There was a U.S. State Department fellow that went to Grenada a couple of days before we invaded and tried to convince the students that they were in danger. And some of them actually thought they were in danger, but there was never any evidence to that effect. We did something similar in the Dominican Republic, 1965. That was the Johnson administration. 83 in Grenada was the Reagan administration. So this goes across party lines. In 1965, we said that U.S. citizens were in danger in Santo Domingo, the capital of the Dominican Republic, during some civil strife in that country. And in fact, there was civil strife, but most of the U.S. citizens who wanted to get out of the country got out actually before we sent in the Marines. So by the time the Marines got there, there was nobody that wanted to be saved. So these pretexts are rather easy to come up with.
You're a professor of international law. Have any American officials ever been prosecuted for perpetuating these ruses, these deceits on the American public and on the foreign public and on those who subsequently lose their lives?
No. To the extent that information came out publicly about any of them, the administrations have typically stonewalled. The Sudan incident that I mentioned, the Sudan government actually went to the UN Security Council and said, we have been the victims of aggression by the United States. They, you know, fired missiles into our territory. And the United States, because of the clout it has in the UN, was able to keep that from being analyzed or investigated by the UN.
In charged political atmospheres, states call each other rogue. Is the United States a rogue state?
I suppose it depends on where you stand, but certainly in the sense of taking action that has no basis in international law, if that's what a rogue state is, then I suppose the United States would be one.
Professor John Quigley of Ohio State University. It is difficult for much of the world to believe President Obama when he says the U.S. wants to protect civilians from the horrors of chemical warfare. After all, the United States itself has slaughtered and poisoned hundreds of thousands with chemical weapons in Vietnam, Iraq, and elsewhere. Black Agenda Report Managing Editor Bruce Dixon has this commentary.
Outside the bubble of ignorance and unreality that corporate media and corporate rule impose upon the U.S. public, the world is horrified and aghast not at the alleged use of nerve gas against Syrian civilians, but at the notion that the United States claims the right to bomb Syria, supposedly to protect its people. From 1961 to 1972, the U.S. military executed the biggest and deadliest chemical warfare operation in human history. It was Operation Trail Dust, in which more than 20 million tons of blended dioxin and other poisons, the most famous known as Agent Orange, were sprayed across 10% of the land area of South Vietnam, along with big tracts of Laos and Cambodia. The objective was to kill the lush triple canopy jungle in which Vietnamese fighters hid and through which they transported supplies, and to kill the animals and crops of Vietnamese peasants in areas the U.S. and its puppets could not control, driving that population into its cities and its so-called strategic hamlets. Many of the estimated 2 million Vietnamese war dead perished from the short-term effects of U.S. chemical warfare, while Vietnamese and other doctors verify that since then an estimated 500,000 have been born with major impairments. To this day, the United States has never accepted any responsibility for this ghastly and ongoing atrocity. Even if we stick only to Western Asia, the U.S. record on chemical weapons used against civilians is unprecedented. During the 1980s Iran-Iraq War, the Pentagon provided Saddam Hussein with satellite intelligence so he'd know where to fire his nerve gas at Iranian troop concentrations. In its two Gulf Wars, the United States military littered Kuwait and Iraq with radioactive depleted uranium munitions, which continue to poison countless civilians today. Hospitals in places like Fallujah report skyrocketing numbers of radiation-induced birth defects. And during the Obama administration, the United States winked at Israel's use of ghastly white phosphorus made in the USA against Palestinian civilians in Gaza. There are treaties banning chemical weapons, but none of them authorize any nation to launch preventive or punitive strikes against those who do. Most Arabs, most of the world, knows this history, and so do more than a few Americans, including much of the so-called left. The foremost practitioner of chemical warfare in human history is about to bomb a country 1/15 its size for its alleged use of chemical weapons. If the Bush-Cheney gang were still in power, we might see Democrats like Melissa Harris-Perry and Rachel Maddow reminding us of this awful record. But there's a Democrat in the White House, so the hypocrisy detectors have been turned off and the history teachers silenced. This is what U.S. policymakers mean when they talk about their right to protect civilians in other countries.
Bar Managing Editor Bruce Dixon, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder reacting to growing black outrage at racism in the criminal justice system, recently made changes in federal sentencing guidelines. But those adjustments aren't likely to help people like People's Lawyer Lynn Stewart, who's serving a 10-year sentence for zealously defending her client in a terrorism case. The Obama administration turned down Stewart's appeals for a compassionate release so that she can be better treated for stage 4 breast cancer. We asked Ralph Pointer, Stewart's husband and lifelong comrade in struggle, how she's holding up.
Her spirits are as good as they ever were because she is very angry about what is happening with the so-called left. They're so involved in perceiving the enemy as those who use the term nigger rather than the real enemy, that is the governments that support them and the government that Obama is a part of. The so-called left who are defending Obama have neglected their struggle to support justice in the rest of the world, and Lynn is a part of that. And she has written letters to professional organizations like the Guild, expressing her unhappiness with their seeming inability to attack this government. She hasn't changed, and she does recognize that this could be the end for her because Obama is continuing to lie, and Holder is making it more difficult. He revised the BOP guidelines on compassionate release, but it's really no change, except that they may consider the nature of the crime. And, you know, Lynn has been charged with terrorism. And so she doesn't look at much coming from that. But she says we must double and redouble our efforts as we have done so far. She's getting worldwide support by mail. She's getting national support. But the organizations that are supposedly left don't seem to be standing up or stepping up to Obama. Hopefully this will change.
Yes, it must be disheartening to see a progressive community that can't even coalesce around stopping a war, much less freeing a people's lawyer from an unjust prison sentence.
And as she says, the main issue is the issue she's been talking about, sadly, for 30 years, and that is understanding that we have political prisoners that must be free. If we can't get our minds around freeing our political prisoners and rejecting the so-called politicians on this issue to support the freeing of our political prisoners, maybe all of our time has come.
Ralph Pointer, speaking from New York. Tony Montero, a professor of African American Studies at Temple University in Philadelphia, says the March on Washington commemoration shows that the old civil rights paradigm is no longer operative, and the people will no longer follow the black misleadership class.
What we are witnessing is a growing class divide and class contradiction, and perhaps even a class conflict, that is a conflict of class ideological and political interests and objectives within the black community. And this might be something quite new in African American history. I mean, I don't believe that there has ever been this wide and contentious of a split between the black elite and bourgeoisie who are aligned through Obama and other mechanisms to finance capital and American empire, and the broad masses, maybe 95% of black people. The reason I say that is the paltry turnout at both marches. They could not get anything close to the numbers that turned out in 1963, or very much, it seemed to me, above 25,000 people. So it showed to me that politically, the elite, the so-called leadership, is in deep trouble with the masses of black people, and I look upon this as a growing class divide and a growing class conflict among African Americans.
It was fascinating to see how seamlessly the speakers went from a purported black leader to an administration spokesperson and then back to a purported black leader.
It was very interesting. And that was on the Saturday march, the Al Sharpton march. But the Obama march was clearly and shamelessly an administration march, as though the torch of the civil rights movement and Martin Luther King in particular had been passed to Barack Obama. Now, I think with that suggestion, they took a big risk. You know, I could be wrong about this, but I think they may have lost political capital and credibility with that type of symbolism. But at the Al Sharpton march, it was another type of passing of the torch, like from the civil rights movement and the 1963 march and King to Al Sharpton, which was I mean, a ludicrous suggestion and a ludicrous symbolism. And he was kind of coronated by old civil rights leaders, unfortunately, like Joseph Lowery. And I say unfortunately because I think when he was healthy, he was an important left-wing figure in the civil rights movement. But of course, Martin Luther King III, who seems to be at this point, as is the case with his brother and sister, a hired hand of the ruling class of the United States to sanitize their father's reputation and to make it a part of the American ruling class's ideological arsenal.
Lowry said, "We came here to celebrate, we go home to agitate, but agitate about what? If the Supreme Court had not gutted the Voting Rights Act, I'm at a loss as to what issues they would be talking about."
That's so very, very interesting, where they need a civil rights issue to even have any credibility. So they take the Voting Rights Act, and of course that is a very important issue, but it is not of the magnitude of the issues that King took up following the passage of the Voting Rights Act, and that is poverty and war and unemployment and human rights. And therefore, to be pro-Voting Rights Act and against what the Supreme Court did and not connect that to the deep suffering of African Americans, where certainly about 80% of us are in or near or on the doorsteps of poverty, is a hollow call. And I don't think it gets any traction among African Americans. And Glenn, I would say for those of us on the black left, we have to find those ways and those arguments and those ideas and those mechanisms and those leaders at the grassroots level who are able to raise the questions of poverty and war and social injustice and human rights. That's what we're called upon to do. Because I think now is the time. I think those marches and the deprecation and desecration of the civil rights movement in general and King in particular is not lost on growing numbers of black folks, especially the younger people who are searching for a left alternative to American politics.
And of course, a new leadership must come out of struggle, and some young people
exactly.
are involved in struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Philip Agnew of the Dream Defenders, who are occupying the Florida state capitol, Al Sharpton saw fit to cut him from the speaker's list.
I'm not surprised, because he would not play by the script. But, you know, a lot of people were cut from the agenda. No mention, serious mention of the prison industrial complex. And if you're going to mention it, let's talk about the political prisoners, one of the most important movements among young people across this country. Is the movement against stop and frisk, the movement against mass incarceration, and, of course, the movement for the freedom of our political prisoners, and in particular, Mumia Abdul-Jamal. And we saw that over the weekend here in Philadelphia, where Public Enemy performed at this big Beyonce concert, and on the stage, they had a big placard calling for the freedom of Mumia, Imam, Jamil Alameen, Rap Brown, Russell Schultz, and Asada Shakur. So something is going on out here, and the mainstream media and the black leaders who live in their cushy suburbs and Manhattan apartments don't know anything about this. But there's something going on. I know here in Philadelphia, a lot of young kids and their parents, who are also young, by the way, are involved in this whole question of these school closings and the chaos in the public school system here. So, you know, I see a glass that is more than half full. I see these misleaders losing the masses that they claim to lead.
But if one talks about the school closings, that puts them in opposition to the Obama administration and its education policies.
No question about it. and people understanding that, and people want to know, how can you go to war again in Syria? We don't know where that's going to end up. And you're closing schools all over this country. And you're telling people that for those schools that are open, we can't provide books. And I won't even mention computers or laboratories or music or even sports, for that matter. There is a growing separation between the black misleadership elite and the masses of black people. They did not show up at the so-called celebrations of the 1963 March, not because they're not interested in celebrating what was achieved in the civil rights movement. They just were not going to be a part of that farce, that fraud, and that desecration.
And when this commemoration is remembered, it won't be because of Al Sharpton's speech, which was not memorable, but they'll be remembering Barack Obama's address.
As he prepared for yet another war, he not only desecrated the legacy of Martin Luther King, but it was yet another vicious attack upon the black poor. And this is the great irony. We're supposed to believe that the torch of freedom and struggle was passed from King to Barack Obama, which means that we are supposed to forget that King embraced the poor and died literally on the picket line, standing with sanitation workers who demanded a union and decent wages, and Barack Obama, whose whole career and presidency is based upon attacking the poor, and in particular, the black poor. And in his speech, what he was saying is that this generation of black people is undeserving of their elders. They are undeserving of the legacy of the civil rights movement, and therefore they are undeserving of education, health care, a peaceful life, a future. And this psychological and ideological predisposition of this man to always attack the black poor, and that's who, he's not attacking black people in general. He's attacking the black poor. And thus he takes up not the mantle of king, but the mantle of the neoliberal white, whose whole agenda domestically begins and ends with an attack upon black poor as undeserving. And that's Barack Obama. And we, you know, we black folks have to just swallow that bitter pill and come to terms with precisely what we're dealing with.
And the word that could not be spoken at that rally was war.
And more than just another war, more than just another Afghanistan or another Iraq or even another Libya, this war could produce a crisis that transcends war and becomes a crisis for humanity itself, a human crisis. They keep talking about a regional war. This could set off a regional war. Well, my question to people who put it like that is, well, was World War I a regional war just because it was fought in Europe? No, it was a world war because the stakes over which they were fighting had to do with who would control the world. And that's the same thing here. This war, because of the way the sides are configuring themselves, would constitute a regional war, yes, but a regional war that is a world war because of the stakes over which they're fighting.
What is the United States fighting for or threatening to bomb for?
See, I think it is more than a resource war. I don't accept that type of reductionist framing of it. Resources are involved, but the bigger questions are strategic. In other words, who will be the global hegemon, which is another way of saying who will control the world's resources and the world's people. And when we talk about resources, we cannot limit them to oil and gas or other resources. We are talking about the main resource of the planet, and that is humanity. And so the U.S. is fighting a strategic war where the objective is to control, like Hitler argued, for a millennium, humanity itself.
Seems like a continuity of the control that has been exercised over humanity by people from Europe for the last 500 years.
Yes, in a certain way, I would say that's true. But, you know, we live in a different technological age. And when we talk about the control of humanity, we're not just talking about the control of nations. We're talking about the control of people right down to the micro level of what the individual thinks, what the individual perceives, what she or he knows. And this is why they are so fascinated with this technology of intrusion into the internet and Facebook, but they see themselves going way beyond that. They feel that they are on the edge of a technology backed up by extraordinary military power, where you would have a single state, not just a nation state, but a state that could have absolute control over all human processes, from the cradle to the grave, from the level of the conscious to the deep structures of the unconscious mind. This is the way I look at it. And thus, it is a crisis for humanity that we're up against. And perhaps we've already crossed that Rubicon here in the United States. Perhaps the crisis for humanity has been resolved and they have won. I don't know. Only time will tell.
Professor Tony Montero of Temple University in Philadelphia. California prison inmates suspended their 9-week hunger strike last week. It was the third time since 2011 that inmates have refused to eat in protest of draconian solitary confinement policies and other abuses. Inmate leaders at the notorious Pelican Bay prison concede that most of their demands were not met. Support groups on the outside helped transmit the prisoners' messages during the strike, which at one point involved 30,000 inmates. Keith James is with the Stop Mass Incarceration Network.
In the United States, there are 80,000 people, and in California, there are over 10,000 people in prison who are living in 8-by-10-foot concrete boxes. They have no sunlight, no fresh air. They never get a chance to see the moon or the stars or the sun. There's no human contact, sensory deprivation, and this goes on not just for days and not just for weeks and not only months, but for years and for decades. At Pelican Bay Prison, where this started, over 400 prisoners have been in these conditions for over 10 years, over 200 for over 15 years, and 78 for over 20 years. This is torture. International organizations, human rights organizations, the United Nations, etc., all view this as torture. This is psychological torture that's going on. This is a systematic effort of the U.S. prison system and the California system to break these prisoners, to crush them, and frankly, it's part of a whole massive campaign of mass incarceration that's been going on since the 1960s, where incarceration has gone from 300,000 people to 2.3 million. Over 8 times in a period where crime, quote unquote, and crime statistics have been declining. So what happened here is that over the last 2 years, there's been a struggle for there to be serious changes made to these conditions, and the California Department of Corrections refused, and the prisoners had to go on this hunger strike. These prisoners are courageous, and they are heroic. This is not over. They're making that very, very clear. There's been international exposure of the United States and its torture regime. There have been, you know, many thousands, even tens of thousands of people, maybe hundreds of thousands, who have been active in different kinds of ways. For example, there's tens of thousands of people who have signed petitions. There's hundreds of families who have been meeting and protesting and out in the streets every week for the last 9 weeks. It's very important to examine the role of the state of California and the California Department of Corrections these last 6 weeks. How did they respond to this? Viciously. They went after these prisoners They took them from the security housing units, these 8x10 foot boxes that they're in. They took them the administrative segregation. They blew blasted cold air on them for 60 days. They withheld their medicine. They ransacked their cells. Any kind of Kool-Aid that, for example, that would have had any kind of glucose in it, ripped off from their cells. They banned their legal representatives from the prison. And not only that, they vilified them to the greatest extent they could in the media, calling them murderers, calling them gangsters, saying that this was a gang ploy for them to control the yards and the California prison system and the outside on the streets. No, that is not what this was. This was a heroic and courageous effort on people in prison who have, in fact, come forward with a call to end racial hostilities in prison, which puts the lie to the California Department of Corrections Chief Jeffrey Beard, his op-eds, their spokespeople, who have incessantly attempted to vilify and do character assassinations of these people. You can look at these prisoners. You can read what they've been writing. People can listen to them. They've even been taped recently by lawyers. And these are prisoners who have changed. They have transformed. They are doing this not only for themselves, but for future generations. And you can see in this the potential of these kinds of people to be the backbone of a fight that would sweep away the mass incarceration and torture and even go beyond that, even sweep away a system. And I said potential, but to sweep away a system that's responsible for this outrageous and barbaric and medieval torture that's going on. The California Department of Corrections in the state of California, they have been denying that there's even solitary confinement in California for the last 9 weeks. It doesn't exist, they say. The prisoners at this point, from my reading of their own statement, was that, you know, on the one hand, they have not actually received a lot of concessions from the California Department of Corrections. They've been intransigent up until now. At the same time, their objective wasn't necessarily for them to die. And this is a protracted battle, and they are waging a protracted battle. And so this is a suspension of the hunger strike at this point. And it's for people on the outside, you know, we really have to have these prisoners back, and including right now, because this torture is not over. It's continuing, this indefinite solitary confinement. And let me just share with people, how do these 10,000 prisoners end up in solitary confinement in California? Are they sent there by a court of law? No, they are not. It's an administrative move on the part of the prisons. There's no due process whatsoever. And the only way these prisoners get out is to parole or to debrief or to die. And debrief is code for point your finger at somebody else and say they're a gang member too, which is what they basically have labeled all of these prisoners.
The inmates who went on strike call themselves the Prisoner Class Human Rights Movement. What's next for them on the inside and for supporters on the outside?
In terms of their views, we'll have to hear from them. I mean, they make clear, and people are encouraged to read their statement, go online, go to stopmassincarceration.net, a group that I work with. You can go to revcom.us, that's Revolution Newspaper. You can go to that newspaper to check out the prisoner's statement that they have to say, and then they will decide what their next moves are going to be. In terms of on the outside at this point, we have been, of course, up till now, very, very urgently, because this was a medical emergency and is still a medical emergency, given these prisoners have been on this hunger strike for 60 days. But we're unfolding a number of plans that have to do with, you know, very high-profile exposure of this. For example, we just printed an advertisement in the LA Times, and we raised thousands of dollars to do it, and it included a statement, very powerful, signed by people such as Viggo Mortensen, the actor, and Michelle Alexander, the writer of The New Jim Crow, Noam Chomsky, the noted intellectual, Tom Morello, the guitarist from, you know, Rage Against the Machine, Cornel West. These people stepped out and signed this statement. We're continuing to distribute that and are printing it in a number of different newspapers. In fact, it was just printed in the area surrounding Pelican Bay in the Del Norte triplicate, which is a very important thing to do. We're exploring the need for a convocation, an emergency convocation, to bring very high-profile people to Los Angeles. This is in the works. This would be a major event that would condemn the torture that's going on. You know, it would support the prisoners very just and reasonable five demands. And then we've got to be down on the ground, down in the street repeatedly in protest. I mean, look, we have been in front of the state building in Los Angeles repeatedly for the last 9 weeks. We've been at the state building in powerful protests. We've been to Corcoran State Prison. And this is very important that this continue, these kinds of demonstrations and actions that continue to expose the crime of indefinite solitary confinement torture.
And there's also a class action suit that is still working its way through the courts.
Yes, exactly, Glenn. Very important as well. The Center for Constitutional Rights has taken over what was originally done, actually, by the prisoners themselves, a formal complaint. Now it's a federal class action lawsuit. It is calling out specifically Pelican Bay for the cruel and unusual punishment and it's, you know, the constitutional violations that are concentrated in that. The California Department of Corrections has attempted to have that court case removed from the courts. They've been unsuccessful, and it's significant that they've used their so-called reforms to try and remove it. And these aren't reforms at all, actually.
And how would you characterize the behavior of California Governor Jerry Brown throughout this whole episode?
A towering outrage. You know, one, this is happening in the context of course, Supreme Court itself, you know, coming out and saying that the California prison system is violating the Constitution because this is cruel and unusual punishment here. These prisons are filled to the brim. You know, there's 33 prisons here in California. I'm calling from L.A. They built a lot of them in this last period to put Black and Latino people in them. Let's just get right to it, okay? That's what they've done, and especially to go after the youth, wherever you're from. Florida, Trayvon Martin, wherever you're from.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda TV. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Jeannie Van Allen.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.